Yesterday at the United Nations General Assembly, Secretary Antonio Guterres said, "Our world is in a whirlwind." He said, "Our world is in a whirlwind." And the whirlwind that Guterres spoke of referred to wars in Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, rising threats posed by global climate change, and the risks of unfettered AI. Our world is in a whirlwind. Guterres is right. Our world is in a whirlwind, and it has been for a long time. You could say it's been sweeping our world ever since Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden. Now, some try to escape the whirlwind with money. They try to buy their way into safety and security, but even places like Paradise, California can burn. Some try to escape the whirlwind by not thinking about it too much. They avoid the news. They numb out on Netflix or some other drug of choice. But even if you're not watching the news and just focusing on what is right in front of you, you can't escape the whirlwind. The whirlwind, the destructive force of sin and chaos, it touches every one of our lives. Does being or becoming a Christian mean that we get to escape the whirlwind? Or does it mean the opposite? Does it mean that we're sent into the whirlwind? I think knowing the right answer to this question is imperative. And it sets up another turning point and test in one's life of faith. Tonight's passage that we're going to look at is Matthew 14, 22 to 36. You can follow along up here or on your handout. It begins this way. Immediately, just to say, immediately after feeding those 5,000 families, that was the passage we looked at last week. So immediately afterwards, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and they cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It's I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. Beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And when they had crossed over the land, they landed at Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized Jesus, they sent word to all the surrounding country. People brought all their sick to him, and they begged him to let the sick just touch the edge of his cloak, and all who touched it were healed. This is God's word to us tonight. And just with open eyes, I'm praying that God would help us to see what we need to see and to hear what we need to hear, that our hearts would be soft, that we might receive what Jesus wants to impress upon us tonight. You know, last week we saw Jesus feed 5,000 families with 5 loaves and 2 fish. With our little, he can do a lot. After this meal, as the sun is setting and darkness is creeping in, Jesus instructs his disciples to get back in a boat and to set sail across the Sea of Galilee back to home base in Capernaum. Now, I'm sure the disciples have a lot of questions at this point, like, why aren't you coming with us? And when are we going to see you again? We don't get answers to those questions. What we do know is that Jesus is staying back in order to dismiss the crowds. And we know that the disciples do as they're told. They get in their boat and they set out across the sea. Now it's dark and the winds pick up and the waves get bigger. And now the disciples are in the middle of a storm, in the middle of a sea, in the middle of the night. They are caught in a whirlwind. Wind and waves are beating up their boat. The gospel writer John gives us the detail that the sails are down and the disciples are rowing at this point. But it is very slow going. And let's be honest, it's scary. I don't know if you've ever been in the middle of a storm on a boat, on a big body of water, but it is very scary to see waves crash over the sides of a boat or ship or canoe or whatever it is that you're in, right? To feel it rocking and to know we could actually die here, like, and now. Adding to the fear and maybe the frustration is this thought question the disciples might have. Like, where is Jesus right now? Where is he? He's gone. He's not here. He's missing. And right when we needed him the most. And maybe an angrier thought bubbles to the surface. That Jesus is the one who got us into this mess. That we are in a boat, in the middle of a storm, in the middle of the sea, in the middle of the night, because he told us to do this. Right? He sent us on this mission. All of this is his fault. I think we need to hit pause for a second and make a quick point of application. Some people think that if they're following Jesus and they're doing what he says, if they're in, quote, his will, they should experience a life of comfort and ease. That life should be smooth sailing. If I'm following Jesus, I'm doing what he says, my life should be smooth sailing. But that just doesn't square with the facts. It doesn't square with the facts of Jesus' life, that he was a perfect person and got nailed to a cross. And it doesn't fit the facts of the disciples' lives either. Like, they are literally following in Jesus' footsteps. They are literally doing what he told them to do. And now they are caught in a whirlwind, not smooth sailing. They are facing opposition, and sometimes head on. They get caught in the whirlwind. I think we all need to repent of our expectation that following Jesus is going to be easy, comfortable, and free of trouble. And we need to embrace the fact that Jesus sometimes sends us into storms on purpose. Sometimes he sends us into dark, scary, and deadly places because he's sending us into the world. And the world is full of whirlwind. Doctors and nurses get this. Soldiers, right, get this. Missionaries understand this. Social workers understand this too. That if we are going to help people this side of heaven, you are going to step into and be sent into the whirlwind. What does Jesus do, though, when he sees his followers caught in the whirlwind? Well, the text says he does more than just pray for them. The text says that he steps into the storm, that he joins them. I want you to look at verses 25 to 27 again with me. It reads, "Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. 'It's a ghost,' they said, and they cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, 'Take courage, it's I, don't be afraid.'" This is, I think, one of the most important stories in the Bible and one of the most important scenes in Simon's life. This semester, we are considering what it means to follow Jesus and what are some important turning points in a life of faith. Something I think clicks in a powerful way when you realize that Jesus is not like some far off or distant deity, but who is right there with you in the midst of life's storms. When that clicks with you, that Jesus is not someone who's far off, but is right with me in the midst of the whirlwind, I think that sends your faith journey on a different course. But if what I'm saying is true, that Jesus is with you in the whirlwind, it matters a lot who Jesus is. For example, if Jesus is just a motivational speaker, if that's all he is to you, all he can do for you when he shows up in life's storms is give you essentially a pep talk. You've got this. right? You go, girl. You go, guy. If you believe it, you can achieve it, right? That kind of a thing, right? If that's all Jesus is just someone who gives you like a quote that you can sort of put behind a background that you can put on Instagram, if that's all he is to you, showing up in life's forums is just that, just pep talk. It's just motivational quotage. If Jesus is just a rabbi or a coach to you, all he can do for you in the middle of life's storms is give you instructions. Grow harder. Right? If Jesus is just a friendly person, just a friendly personality to you, all he can do for you in the middle of life's storms is give you essentially a hug. It matters that Jesus shows up in the whirlwind. It matters that Jesus shows up in the storms of our life. But how he shows up matters most of all. And what this text makes very clear is that the Jesus who shows up in your life storms and the whirlwind is none other than God himself. I know this is hard for some of you to believe, and maybe it's encouraging for you to see in this text that this was hard for the disciples. Disciples like Simon to believe too. Like they struggled with this reality. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this is who Jesus is. And this matters a lot because when we say that Jesus is with you in your storms, what we in the Bible are saying is that God is with you in your storms. I want you to see how our passage makes this jaw-dropping point. But in order to do that, I need you to hang with me for like 2 minutes and just give you a little bit of Old Testament background. So just bear with me, 2 minutes. In the Old Testament, there is a famous story of Moses who happens upon a burning bush in the wilderness. And a voice comes out of the bush telling Moses to take his sandals off because he's on holy ground. The voice from the burning bush identifies himself as the God of Moses' father and the God of Abraham and Jacob and Isaac. The voice says, "I have seen the affliction of my people in slavery, and I want you to go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go." And Moses protests. He says, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh?" He is afraid. He's afraid to go into that whirlwind. He knows that if he steps into Pharaoh's court and says this, it's going to be a storm, right? And he's afraid. You would be too. But the voice says, "Don't be afraid. I will be with you." Moses responds, "Okay. But if I come to the people of Israel and I say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" And the voice of God says from the burning bush to Moses, "I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you." Literally, in Hebrew, that word or that phrase that translates "I am" is the name, the divine name, Yahweh. Tell them Yahweh has sent them to you. Tell them "I am has sent me to you." There are lots of places and passages in the Old Testament where we hear Yahweh, the Lord, right, address his people. I want you to just see three of them from the Old Testament. I'm putting these up before you. Psalm 46, 1 to 2 and verses 10 to 11. "It's God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." The Lord, there in Hebrew it says Yahweh. The Lord, Yahweh Almighty, is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Isaiah 41:13. "For I am the Lord, Yahweh, your God, who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, 'Do not fear, I will help you.'" Isaiah 43:1-4, what we just sang. "Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. For I am the Lord. I am Yahweh, your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior, and I love you." These texts, Exodus, Psalms, Isaiah, they were all written in Hebrew, but the New Testament was written in Greek. And the only way that you can say Yahweh in Greek is ego eimi, which means "I am." That's how you say Yahweh in Greek, ego eimi. And the way you say Lord in Greek, is kurios. Those are your two options for communicating, right, the Lord. And both of these words show up in our passage tonight. Jesus comes to his disciples in the middle of a storm, in the middle of the sea, in the middle of the night, and he says, take courage, I am. Don't be afraid. And when he says this, he looks and sounds a lot like the God of the Old Testament. And Simon gets the message. Jesus is showing up as Yahweh in our midst. He's looking the part, he's speaking the part. Ego in me, I am, don't be afraid. But he's having a hard time believing this. He says, Lord, kurios in Greek, probably Adonai in Hebrew, if it is really you, tell me to come to you on the water. It's like, Jesus, if you are really Yahweh, command me to come out to you. If it's true that that's who you are. There are lots of differing opinions as to what is going on here. Like, is Simon being courageous? Is he sort of showing off? My own take is this. I think Simon is really struggling to put two and two together. I think he's having a really hard time believing that the Lord of the universe is actually with them and the person of Jesus Christ. I think he's having a very hard time believing that the voice of the burning bush, the God who created all things, is now walking on water and addressing them as Yahweh. So he says, if it's really you, Lord, if it's really you, tell me to come. He wants proof of some sort. And Jesus says, come. Peter hops out of the boat and he doesn't sink. And he starts walking too. And every step on the water confirms the incredible that Jesus is Yahweh. Jesus is Lord. That he is Emmanuel, God with us. But then Peter starts to lose focus. He starts to pay more attention to the whirlwind than the Jesus who is with him in it. And he gets afraid and he starts to sink. And this, I think, is so relatable. Again, it's why we have so much information about the life of Simon Peter. His life is such an honest glimpse into what the life of faith really looks like. Jesus is with us in our storms. And when we realize that, our faith skyrockets and we are brave. But then we see the horrible things on the news, or the horrible things on our city streets, or the horrible things on our campus, or even in our homes. And we forget about that fact of life. And we start to sink. We start to lose faith. We start to go under. Y'all, sometimes I get scared. I get scared when I think about the whirlwind. When I think about wars overseas, when I think about politics, particularly American politics and like what our nation is heading towards, when I think about climate change or just sort of like the uncertainties around AI, I worry. But my fear turns to dread when all I see is the scary thing and I lose sight of Jesus. When Jesus, who is there with me in the midst of the storm, and I focus on the storm itself, and I lose Jesus amongst the wind and the waves, as it were. And when that happens, dread sets in. Peter loses sight of Jesus. He only sees the scary thing. He only sees the wind and the waves. And he experiences existential dread in that moment. Right, his faith flags and he starts to sink. And as he sinks, he cries out, save me. And Jesus does. And it calls to mind, right, that Isaiah passage. For I am the Lord, your God, who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, don't fear, I will help you. It's almost verbatim. Peter's crisis of faith and then Jesus' rescue teaches us something I think super important about saving faith. Weak faith in a strong God is better than strong faith in a weak God. Weak faith in a strong God is better than having strong faith in a weak one. You could put it this way. Weak faith in Jesus is better than very strong faith in not Jesus. Jesus does not see Peter's faith flagging and say, psh, sorry, Peter, I only save people who are serious about me and who never doubt. Right? He doesn't do that. On the contrary, Jesus saves people whose faith needs saving. That's what this text shows. It shows that weak faith in a strong God is better than strong faith in a weak God, and that Jesus saves people whose faith needs saving. What saves us too is not how tightly we're holding on to Jesus, but how tightly he's holding on to us. That is the basis of your assurance. What you can, the grounds your surety, like I am saved, is not how tightly I'm holding on to Jesus, but how tightly Jesus is holding on to me. That is what gives me security. That is my guarantee that his grip on me is tighter than my grip on him. I'm sure your dad did this for you when you were young. I do it for my children, where you grab them sort of by the hands, by the wrists, and you kind of like spin them like this. And their legs go out and they sort of say, wee, as they kind of go around in a circle. What is preventing Willa, like when I do that with my daughter and I'm spinning her around, what is preventing her from like flying off into this table over here and like breaking her arm? Is it how tightly Willa is holding on to me, or is it how tightly I'm holding on to her? Like, what is preventing her from flying off and seriously hurting herself? Is it her grip, or is it mine? I tell you, it's my grip, right? When Jesus asks, why did you doubt? It's kind of a question like this. Who is more powerful, Peter? Is it the whirlwind or the one who walks on it? It's not a question meant to shame, but it is meant to make you think and be like, oh yeah, why did I doubt? Who's more powerful, the whirlwind or the one who walks on it? Whose grip strength is greater? Is it yours or mine, Peter? Right, it's yours. Right. Jesus is saying, Peter, I love you, and I will never let you go. Even when you go under, even when your friends can't see you anymore because you're beneath the waves, you're enveloped in the whirlwind, or even in your grave, know this, I am strong enough that I can reach down and I can lift you up. My grip on you is that tight. What do you do in the presence of a Jesus like this? A God like this? Well, the disciples do something they have not done until this moment in time. They worship him. This is the first time in the Bible where we actually have the disciples worshiping Jesus. He's not just a carpenter. He's not just a rabbi. He's not just a miracle worker. And he's not just their friend. He's God, and they worship him, and Jesus receives their worship. He doesn't say, no, 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 you got the wrong ideas about me. He receives it, because the disciples are thinking things through. They're connecting dots in the way that they're supposed to, and worshiping Jesus makes sense. It makes sense because he's powerful, but more than that, he's loving, he's saving, he's worthy of worship. The disciples worship Jesus, but that's not all they do. The text also says they get back to work. That's why that last passage, that last paragraph is there, and you're like, what is this? I think this is what's going on. Jesus sent them into one storm, but there's more storms to follow because he's sending us into the world, right? He's sending them into a world that is full of pain and hurt, where there is sick people to heal, and broken lives that need to be put back together again. They went through a whirlwind, but there are more whirlwinds. But the disciples are able to enter those whirlwinds with a newfound perspective and presence and power because God is with them. He's with us. He's with us in the whirlwind, and he will be with us on the other side. Let me pray.